So no relationships to disclose. Let me just start us off with the first thank you all of you for coming. If you've never seen a picture of Irving Goffman, there's a picture of Irving Goffman. It's our studies about stigma. Just start here for a brief moment. Sort of everything starts with Goffman. Here's his book, and that one of the definitions of stigma that he gave, an attribute that's deeply discrediting and reduces the bearer from a whole and usual person to a tainted and discounted one. Joe Phelan and I sat down for a while and tried to think through stigma again after Goffman and had this set of thoughts about what stigma is, kind of like it's an umbrella concept. It includes all of these six things. First, people distinguish and label human differences. They pluck out differences. There's all sorts of differences we could pluck out, but we pluck out some for salience that then influence our interactions with others. Then the second component is the label or the distinction that we pulled out is linked to an undesirable characteristic, to an unwarranted negative stereotype. So if you hear that someone's been hospitalized for mental illness in a hospital, and then you assume that they are necessarily dangerous or incompetent, that would be an unwarranted negative stereotype. Third component is labeled persons are viewed as different, as a them, not an us, separated from us, and there's that group distinction. Fourth is that people experience emotional reactions to labeled people, maybe fear, repulsion, disgust, and labeled persons may feel shame, embarrassment, or humiliation. And then fifth, labeled persons experience status loss and downward placement and discrimination, exclusion from jobs, housing, so on. And finally, that stigma is dependent on power. It's the powerful who decide which differences to select out. It's the powerful who make the unwarranted stereotypes that are ambient in our culture exist. And it's the powerful who hold access to the housing and the jobs and the educational opportunities. And so it takes power to pull off all that ends up being stigma. So that's just an introduction to the concept, very briefly. And there's some consequences of stigma for persons with mental illness. Delayed help seeking for mental health problems, discrimination in housing, jobs, medical care, rights of citizenship, abusive treatment, being victimized or bullied, social exclusion, being excluded from social networks or romantic relationships, or just how you feel about yourself, your self-esteem, whether you feel depressed, or your general quality of life. And there have been broad types of interventions to try to address those negative consequences of stigma. One are self-stigma interventions directed toward people with mental illnesses themselves, where self-stigma refers to the internalization of negative stereotypes and all the complications and negative outcomes that can lead to if you accept the negative stereotypes applied to you because you've been developed a mental illness. And then public stigma interventions directed at the general public. So here's a meta-analysis of attempts to address self-stigma done by Mittal. Of 14 studies, 8 showed significant post-intervention reductions in self-stigma, but the effect sizes were really pretty small to maybe medium in some instances. Only 2 of the 7 studies directed towards those with psychosis showed significant results at all, and little evidence of long-lasting benefits of the interventions have been shown. So to the extent that they had an effect, it was short-term. There's progress, yes, but it's certainly no major breakthrough. What about changing public conceptions? A major effort has been made over the past several decades to move mental health conditions away from being viewed within a social deviance model to an illness model. And one effort to assess overall changes involved modules of the General Social Survey conducted in 1996 and 2006 using the same methodology. Of all these efforts to change public stigma, how were we done in that gap of 10 years? Subjects were presented with a vignette depicting the alcohol dependence, schizophrenia, major depression, or me on a bad day, a troubled person, and there are little descriptions given. And while there were some changes in public conceptions toward an illness model, between 1996 and 2006, core aspects of stigma remained unchanged. I'll just give you a couple of examples. So the orange bars are 2006, the green bars are 1996, the likelihood that the person with mental illness would be violent towards others, no change. Willingness to interact with people, the vignettes as described for alcohol dependence, major depression, schizophrenia, no change basically over those two decades. And the strong difference between these groups and the troubled person. So basically, these core aspects haven't been addressed. So how might we induce change in core aspects of stigma? We reasoned that the effort to change fundamental conceptions needs to be broadly disseminated in a sustained effort and directed toward the right audience at the right time. So in a collaboration between stigma researchers at Columbia University and mental health intervention experts in Tarrytown, Texas, we are currently testing a school-based intervention that aims to meet these criteria. It's schools. There's schools all over the place. There's schools in rural Alaska. You can do an intervention in schools. Sustained effort, the idea that would be that you can create a curriculum and do it every year. And directed towards the right audience, we thought sixth grade was about the right time to mount an intervention. So our design in brief is sixth grade classes are assigned to one or a combination of three interventions. Curriculum, which you'll learn more about, interpersonal contact with someone with a mental illness, or materials, posters, bookmarks, or to no intervention. There was a random assignment at the school level to interventions with children being interviewed pre-intervention, post-intervention, and then 6, 12, 18, and 20 months later. We are in the middle of this study. We're going to tell you the pre-post results. Here's our sample. We have 721 children in it. Average age is 11 and a half. About half were female. Many of them, of the Hispanic and Latino youths, reported Spanish as their primary language. And as you see from our pie chart over there, it's a multi-ethnic sample. We like this because we want to see whether the intervention works broadly across groups, not just in one group. So here's a brief overview of the talks. I'm supposed to do the rationale, measures, and the need for the intervention based on the baseline data. Then you hear about the interventions themselves from Kay Barkin. Then we're going to have the pre-post interventions from Chris Painter. Then we're going to talk about race-ethnic variations and help-seeking by Melissa DuPont. And then finally, Joe Phelan is going to talk about social class, social desirability, and self-retort measures of stigma. So we reasoned that in order to evaluate this intervention, we needed a multi-method approach to measurement. So we had an open-ended question concerning what mental illness is. Before we asked them anything, we just asked them, what do you think mental illness is? Self-reports of knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors about mental illnesses and help-seeking for such illnesses, so self-reports. Responses to vignettes, so that self-reports are about what you give them the cue of mental illness, and then whatever they think about mental illness, they respond to. The vignettes give a specific disorder so we know what we've presented them, and we can get their responses in that way. We're not going to talk about these final two, but we've developed implicit attitudes towards mental illnesses that we're going to get in subsequent reports. And we also have the parents' reports. So this open-ended question, everyone comes from Shirley Starr, a very famous person in public attitudes towards mental illness. In 1950, she asked this question of a sample of the United States. Everyone hears a lot about physical illnesses and disease, but what about the ones we call mental illness? When you hear someone say that a person is mentally ill or has a mental illness, what does that mean to you? And then the youth responded to that question verbatim by tapping it into their computer. And we got their responses, and three of us coded 33 dimensions of what they said. And we're generally able to do it pretty well. But here I'm supposed to also say, is there a need for an intervention? And here's one example of a need for an intervention from this open-ended question. 16.1% of the responses indicated that he or she was thinking mainly about intellectual disability when they said what they thought about mental illness. And we were able to code that very well. In terms of self-report measures about mental illness in general, we adapted and developed self-report measures drawing heavily on Otto Wall, who's also a consultant on our study. We have a knowledge and attitude scale that you'll see some. It's a 23 items, everything we wanted to change in those domains, sort of. We had a social distance scale, which is very common, and it's a 6-item scale. And then a familiarity and a willingness to communicate about mental illness problems are examples of the kinds of measures. I'm going to show you some results from just items from those scales that give you an indication of the need. This is the baseline data. Do we need an intervention? Okay. It would be embarrassing to have a mental illness. Now, substantial proportion either say, yeah, that would be embarrassing, or unsure about that. So we could change that. People with mental illness tend to be dangerous or violent. Not many people agree with that, only 12%, but a lot are unsure. So we can talk to them about that. Most people with severe forms of mental illness do not get better, even with treatment. So a large proportion just don't know whether people can get better. Almost half are uncertain about it. Social distance from a child with mental illness. There you see those who probably know, want to be involved in these ways. Make a friend, be a neighbor, eat lunch with, sit next to, class project, invite home. So there's quite a few who say no about those things, then maybe we can change that. And actions to take into communicate or familiarity about mental illnesses in the past 2 weeks. Search the internet, talk to family, or feel comfortable talking to friends. You see that a fairly small proportion say yes to that. This is something we want to change. The vignette-based measures, this is what we did. We created two vignettes. I'm not going to read these to you, but one describes bipolar illness in a youth, and the other describes anxiety disorder in a youth. And we read those, the students read those and then answer questions about them. We had social distance questions about wanting to be near Julia or David, and we asked, you know, what should they do? Should they seek help, yes or no, and so on. So here's about the Julia and David seeking help. About a quarter would say, no, they shouldn't seek help for these problems for both Julia and David. Across these items. So there's room for change in a positive direction. So my conclusion now is public stigma, that is trying to intervene to change the way public thinks about mental illness, is important because, one, it forms the cultural context that shapes the internalization of stereotypes or creates the possibility of self-stigma. It gives people the stereotypes that they can internalize. Second, it constitutes the attitudinal and behavioral context in which people experience the development of mental disorders. And then changing public stigma requires a public mental health approach that can be easily disseminated, used year after year, in a group that is at the right development stage for intervention. This entire symposium is about an evaluation of such approach. My talk briefly described the measurement package of multi-method measurement that we adopted and developed to assess change, and two, use baseline data on those measures to document a few examples of the need for such change. The next talk is about the intervention and that the speaker, Kay Barkin, actually developed and that we are evaluating. And so I'm going to invite Kay to come up and be the next speaker.